Today's Tesho is from Case 25, from The Hidden Lamp. It's a collection of stories from 25 centuries of awakened women. This case is entitled Moshan's Mountain Summit. The monk Guanxi Jian was sent by his teacher, Master Lingji, to meet Master Moshan, a powerful woman teacher. When the student Guanxi arrived at Mount Moshan, the place where she taught, he refused to bow to her or take off his traveling hat. He instead asked, "What is Moshan?" Moshan replied, "The summit cannot be seen." He then asked, "Who is the master of Mount Moshan?" She replied, "Without the form of a man or a woman." He shouted, "Why doesn't she transform herself?" She replied, "She is not a wild fox spirit, nor a ghost. What would you have her become?" At that response, Guanxi bowed and took off his hat. He became the gardener at her monastery and stayed for 3 years. So this is our beautiful third day for most people, where I'm hopeful that all of you, except maybe Amy, who is still climbing the mountain in her first day, others are, if not in all their sits, but in some of their sits, and hopefully many of their sits, are reaching a more still place, a calmer place. From what I can tell by just looking at the faces around the room and just noticing my own experience for the 60th something time, things really do shift by third day. It's like we have been trying hard. Some sits are grueling, really grueling on the first day. And then breath by breath, it's like we are climbing, you know, it's like we are hanging with this rope and trying to scale this mountain. And we don't stay at any mountain peak forever. But if you get access to some clarity, some stillness, please enjoy the taste. And you know, there are times I myself feel doubtful, do I really want to go back to those crazy intense sessions? But what I remember, and Imtiaz was referring to it yesterday, I remember the taste of that stillness, that utter clarity. I don't want to add too many adjectives, because in Zen we don't describe those experiences. They are beyond words. But you remember that taste. It's clear, it's sweet, precious. So this case, before I talk about the case, let me say this. If you are not at a still place, you know what you got to do, right? We've said this so many times. Let's keep coming back to that space. If you are following the Hara method, right, the classical method that I grew up with, so to speak, we go back to that space between our out-breath and our next in-breath. right? And there's actually one more thing I wanted to say about that. To go to sort of the next level, let's say you are able to come to a pl that place, that hypothetical place, somehow. Even if you're not fully conscious of it, you are feeling overall more composed and present. So how do we take it to the next level? And I was taught this method when I was working on the Mukon. It's called bamboo breathing. Anyone heard of that before? Sakida talks about it beautifully in his book Zen Training, that I highly recommend if you are the kind of technical person who's always wanting what's the next technique I can kind of work with in my practice, seated practice. So what Sakida says, I don't necessarily like the name he gave this method, but he called it bamboo breathing. I don't have a better name necessarily, but I can't figure out why he called it bamboo breathing. But here's how it goes, right? So we breathe in, and the classical Zen method, I always say, we've done this before, your belly swells up, your abdomen swells up, right? Even if it's slight, it's like as if there was a balloon here. And then you breathe out, you squeeze the air out, your diaphragm moves naturally. And that's the state I say, this is the state where your hara is kind of taut, right? Not loose, not, you don't want to break it, making it, squeezing it too much, but it's slightly taut. And then we say, well, then the breath comes in again naturally, your belly swells up again, and then you breathe out again. So in this bamboo breathing method, what Sakida described, and I work with it myself all the time, is that he says, when you breathe in, don't allow your belly to swell up all the way again. It's like maintain the tautness of your hara, of your lower abdomen, right? And then push ever so slightly. When you squeeze it just slightly more inward each time you breathe. So it's like sequentially, your hara is more and more and more and slightly more taut, right? You can only do it for maybe 3, 4, 5 breaths, but it's like successively you are stilling your whole system. Does that make sense? We don't release our belly all the way forward, like the balloon doesn't fill up all the way each time. So for those 3, 4 times, we are maintaining a slight tension in our lower abdomen. And I hope it makes sense. I'm happy to talk more about it. But if you are working on Mu, or if you're working on a koan in the classical in a classical way, the invitation is that at each out breath, as your hara is becoming slightly taut or tauter, tighter, right? Without making it an ab workout, please don't hurt yourself. People can hurt themselves by squeezing it too much. You can get stomach pain from doing this in a wrong way. So you have to honor your body. We should respect the limits of our body. Go gently. But if you are ready, right, and you breathe this way, at each out breath, you say the turning phrase of your koan. So if you are working on Mu koan, as you are breathing out, you are internally, without making an audible sound, you are saying, and as you are exhaling out, your hara is taut, and then you fill up with air again, and then you again go. And there is in this calling moo in your mind, or your the turning phrase of your koan. Let's say you were working on this koan, and your turning phrase was, let's make it up. Why doesn't she transform herself? So transform herself, transform herself. So at every out breath, as you are breathing out, you would say internally, transform. You can just pick one word instead of saying transform herself. And the point is, there are two things happening here. One is that we are kind of turning the question, the inherent contradiction of the koan, into a mantra. It's like there's like a mantra-like effect. But the second important part of any koan is the curiosity, right? Curiosity. You don't necessarily know what that means, but you are deeply curious. You have, we bring, Zen is not, Zen requires some faith that there is something like you know, big mind, enlightened mind, Buddha mind. It requires some faith that human beings can reach that stage. But other than that, Zen is all about curiosity, right? It's not asking us to believe any written scriptures. It's saying we can experience the deep depths of Buddha mind, right? We don't necessarily know what it is unless we have tasted layers of it, but we can curiously investigate. We can be the scientists, right? We can hold that curiosity. So if you are working on Mu, you repeat that phrase over and over again, right? At your out breath, have it work on you like a mantra. That has an effect of its own. But the second point is just these very, very deep intent. It's, they say, arouse your curiosity, right? Like, I don't have access to the Mumonkon now, but you're welcome to read the Mukon in Mumonkon. It says something like, arouse 10,000 pores of your body and all your energy, summon up, you know, just like Zen language is so dramatic. I wish I could remember how Mukon is described. It's just extremely poetic, and it's basically asking you, just garner up all your curiosity, focus yourself in that, on that phrase, like, what is Mu, right? And when Zen teachers ask folks to call Mu in Dokusan room, you might have heard some shouts and screams yesterday. It wasn't, they weren't scream, they can include some frustration, but they are not limited to that, right? Calling Mu in Dokusan room, we do that to make ourselves available. That's the best possible phrase that comes to my mind. You know, yesterday Imtiaz was talking about surrender, right? We can surrender in many different ways. We can surrender to the schedule of a rigorous meditation retreat. We can surrender to our pain, and on and on. What calling Mu in some ways in Dokusan room is about is surrendering and making ourselves available for universal energy, right? Many different traditions do Mu Koan in different ways. So what I am saying might not necessarily resonate with you if you've done Mu with another Sangha, another tradition. But the way I learned working with, we learned, Imtiaz and I learned working with Mu is, we go in Dokusan room. There can be testing questions later on, but the first step is demonstrating that we have surrendered completely. And that demonstration comes, the person playing the teacher role, right, says, call Mu wholeheartedly, call Mu. And you open your mouth and, you know, at first we are just conscious. It's like, do I have to be clever about it? Does my Mu have to be a lion's Mu or, you know, a bird's Mu, or what's a human Mu, right? But one day it happens, we open our mouth and universe speaks through us. And we can only experience it, it cannot be described. We make ourselves available and we surrender and we say, I don't know what's going to come out, right? And when the person in teacher's role yells with you, invites you to shout with them, they are basically just trying to make you more available. They are just trying to get you out of the thinking mind. And they're saying, you know, let's leave all the thinking behind, shake it off. Let's become available right now, right? Okay, so much about Mu. I didn't mean to go on about this, but I think it's important because some of you are working on that. So back to this koan. One monk, I'm not even sure I'm not pronouncing the name correctly. I would have to check the dictionary later. But Guanxi worked with a very powerful teacher, Linji. Linji was the founder of Rinzai Zen tradition. That's the tradition that I and Imtiaz were trained in, still train in. And he was very fierce, very fierce. He's famous for, I won't do it, I promise, but he is famous for beating and slapping people and pushing them away. His method was really revolutionary for those times where people used a lot of words to describe enlightened state of mind or whatever. That was his perception. And his way was cut through all of those words. You know, if he found a student ready, he would push them, scream at them, and things like that. So this monk had done some training with Master Linji. Linji is the Chinese version Is Rinzai Chinese version? Linji is Chinese and Rinzai is Japanese, right? So this monk had trained with Linji, and it was usual for monks after a few years, if there were other great teachers in the area, they would visit them. So he had heard of this female teacher called Mo Shan, and he came to visit her. Mo Shan, made of two characters, Mo and Shan. Shan means mountain, and Mo means summit, right? Peak of a mountain. So he arrives there. When he arrived at Mount Mo Shan, so this is also not uncommon in Asia that a peak or a village is named after the teacher who teaches there. So this place is called Mount Mo Shan after this teacher Mo Shan. And he arrived there, but he refused to acknowledge her. He refused to bow to her. It's like just the normal greeting, right? This is the Buddhist hello, if nothing else. And he refused to take off his traveling hat. Taking off the traveling hat in those times was also a sign of saying, I am here, I am available, I surrender, I am here to learn, right? So he's giving mixed messages. He's arriving there and not bowing and not taking the traveling hat. And instead he asks, what is Mo Shan? Right? So he questions the teacher without saying hello. There is more to this story in the longer version of this, but in this short version, Moshan replies, "The summit cannot be seen." Right? Summit cannot be seen. So, you know, if you look at the meaning of her name, the meaning of her name is summit. And she is saying, summit cannot be seen. She's not saying, I cannot be seen. She's pointing to the deeper reality, right? When we talk about the absolute realm, in the absolute realm, in some ways we become blind, deaf, it's tasteless. It's like how we describe Hath Sutra, right? No eyes, no ears, no taste, no seeing, no hearing. So how can anything be seen? So it's like the student was testing the teacher and she replied. And then he asked a second question. Who is the master of Mount Moshan? Right? Like maybe he expected her to say something like, oh, I am the master who teaches here. I am the Zen teacher here. Or, you know, whatever. He was provoking her. And she replied, without the form of a man or a woman. Or she could have said, both the form of a man and a woman, or neither a man nor a woman. He shouted, and this is one of the rare places where Buddhism addresses patriarchy. He shouted, why doesn't she transform herself? The question is just left there, but there are historical references to indicate that he meant, why doesn't she transform herself into a man? Like, what are you doing in a woman's body, right? You should have been a man to be teaching. And she replied, I mean, they say if she was following Rinzai's style, by now she would have slapped and beaten the hell out of him. But she replied, she is not a wild fox, spirit, or a ghost. What would you have her become? So this is where transformation happens. Guanxi bowed and took off his hat finally. He became the gardener at her monastery and stayed for 3 years. Records say in the older version of this story that he really learned a lot from her, and after a few years he said, I got half a ladle cup of teaching from Linji and half from Moshan. So what's happening here, right? I cannot present the resolution of the koan. I only present the basics of the story. And then the point is, you know, we all internalize some version of this question for us during the retreat or later. And when you actually work on it, you can find out what different things meant or not. Why I thought about this koan, there are many different things, right? As in web of life, many different things brought me to this koan. One of it is there were some things happening yesterday, and I was thinking about the role that I am playing here. Right? I am in quote unquote teacher's role. And I've been in a student role for 15 years. Is that 15? 18 years. I'm still in a student role when I do retreats with multiple teachers. And now I'm in a student role, taking a teacher's role. And I have always known power of a teacher's role. Like at a retreat, for the most time, it's the person in teacher's role who talks and everyone else is expected to be silent. Right? A teacher can make a remark in sincerity, but in the pressure cooker atmosphere of a retreat, it can pierce us in ways that hurt, because there is power embedded in that role. Teacher wears robes or special raksus or whatever, you know, there are however much we might strip down those things, but there is some inherent power in that role. And the trick is that to be effective, a teacher has to hold that role. Person playing the teacher's role has to do that skillfully, to use that power dynamic to help all of Sangha, including herself, to go deeper into practice. If they don't do it, they end up abusing it. And our Zen world and our Mahayana world is full of abuse of power. Right? So I want to be so cognizant of that power at all times. And if I'm not honoring that role, I hope everyone will let me know, because it's important for a person playing the teacher's role. I am not the teacher. I am the person playing the teacher's role. They are two different things. The teacher is within each of us, and teachers are all around us. We learn from our own inner curiosity. We learn from our own becoming blind and groping in the dark in Mu and looking at our koan and turning it inside out and, just every which way. The person in teacher's role has responsibility and power to help us, but if they are not doing it, they need mirrors to do that well. So please be my mirror. It doesn't mean that we question each and everything that's happening at a retreat. That's also not productive. I mean, if everything is going off in a retreat, then the group is not helpful for us. And I hope that's not the case for anyone here. I don't see those indications. But it's not healthy to be constantly critiquing a group or a teacher. It just doesn't work. But a healthy feedback is important. So that was one part, right? Holding the teacher's role and then watching our own reaction to being in the quote-unquote student role. And a lot of this koan is about that dynamic, right? Some of it certainly is, right? This person, this male student, has trouble accepting the student's role because the person in teacher's role is a female. Yeah? So he's questioning, he's a little harsh. He goes on to the extent of saying, transform yourself into a man, and then what you say will be worthy of my respect or my attention. And it's okay. As much as a teacher should test a student, people in student's role should also be, hopefully not rudely, but gently testing their teacher, right? Please don't slap me in Dokusan room tonight. But what I mean to say is that our ability to learn from a situation, from a retreat, from any situation depends on our surrender and our ability to get into that role. See the limits of that role. And yet, if we are constantly questioning it, it won't work. The other part of it is, when I say the actual teacher, is without the form of a man or a woman. Or if I might say, the actual teacher is without the form of a man or a woman or a human being or a fellow Sangha member. It goes beyond it. Yesterday we were hiking up and I found this, I will have to call it a rock, right? We give things names. I invite you to look at this closely after when we break. But this piece of rock, I don't know how many minerals it hides within itself. Its surface is lined up with lichens. And you know, lichens, it's a symbiotic relationship of two species, one algae, one fungus. And they are living symbiotically. One is fixing carbon dioxide into food and the other is helping absorb nutrients and water. And when I found this, it was like, so this was so alive, I don't want to get into personal lessons I learned from this teacher, but it was just very alive. It resonated me in very deep ways at that moment. And that moment, this was the teacher. The point that I'm trying to make is, while there is a person being in the teacher form, me or Imtiaz, or you know, those are like, we have to hold those roles somewhat seriously because they help us with sense of discipline and rigor, and there is a structure of this retreat. On the other hand, everyone here is our teacher. I'm learning from everyone. I of course learn all the time from Imtiaz, like he gently, you know, it's like, well, he's also my husband, so you know, there is a spousal dynamic too, but he's always my teacher, and so are all of you. And I hope we approach everyone, including all beings on this land, you know, trees, moors, rocks, river, creek, clouds, lichen, algae, sunlight. In stillness, everyone is our teacher. And what I want to invite you to do, you know, when we go out hiking in the afternoon, if you go with the group or you go by yourself, I want to offer 2-3 thoughts on how to do nature practice. You might already have your nature practices. One way we can practice in nature is to really pose a question to the natural being that you have in front of you. You can bring a question to the river. That's one of my favorite activities. It's not classical Zen approach to do that, but you can pose a question to a mighty tree. Trees hold a lot of wisdom. They've been standing there for decades many times, sometimes centuries, watching the landscape. Yeah? River has been flowing for millennia. River Saint Rain here was flowing here maybe before, you know, native people lived here. Who knows what she's holding in herself? And we can ask her when we sit there in silence. The other thing we could do is watch the patterns in nature. Sometimes we have a conscious or subconscious question or problem in our life, and we don't necessarily even know what question to ask. But observing patterns in nature, you know, how does a leaf, which is flowing in the river, how does it interact with the bank? How does it interact with the soil? I might not make sense. What I'm trying to say is there are patterns in nature. Folks who study permaculture probably would know exactly what I mean. I mean, even scientists study patterns in nature, and permaculture folks pay special attention to learning from patterns in nature. Yeah, I guess that's exactly what I'm saying. I didn't make the connection until right now. We can learn from those patterns in nature, and they can help us with our life questions. So there is a Guan Xi in all of us. There is a Guan Xi in us when we confront a new situation, a new teacher, a new sangha, a new land, a new dokusan room. It's like, what the hell am I doing here? Is this situation right enough for me? Am I ready to be transformed in the presence of this situation, in the midst of this situation? We make up conscious and unconscious questions. We hold them tight in our hearts. Is this right enough for me? I'm not going to love you yet. I'm going to test you. You must change your form to be able to teach me. That's fine. This is all human. But when you have a little bit of trust, when you have a little bit of trust, put down your hat, make a bow. Millions of teachers abound. And I am learning from all of you. Even though I am in the quote-unquote priest role, when I stop learning, I will be causing harm. And I hope that will, if it happens in small ways, I will work on them. I hope it won't happen in any big way. Because as a woman, it really hurts me that we have had a lot of problems in our Zen sanghas, including sexual abuse, abuse of power, abuse of money. And I hope in whatever ways we interact, I won't go too far off. So make an internal bow and let's keep learning from each other. Thank you.